This is the 17th Naman interview, recorded on the 12th of October, 2015. We interview people with ideas that deserve a closer look. My name is Johannes van der Mulle of Naman, and today we have Philippe van den Broek, founding partner of Shift N, which is a Belgium-based strategy consultancy. Philippe gave a talk here at Naman a few days ago with the title Systems Thinking for Wicked Problems, Pipe Dream or Cure All.
Wicked problems are a relatively recent phenomenon. It's, let's say, as a cultural meme, wicked problems is an invention of the early 70s, I would say. It was Horst Rittel, who was an urban planner, who first came up with this notion in a paper he wrote about planning problems, and he characterized them as inherently wicked, meaning that they were ill-defined and reliant on political judgment. And so the punchline was, wicked problems are never solved. At best, they are resolved over and over again. And so what Rittel expressed there was that there is a class of problems that exhibit both high technical complexity and social complexity, meaning they're complicated. There is not a single problem, but there is a network of interdependent problems. And the way people look at them, different stakeholders, differs. So there is not a shared view on what a problem actually is. So it's a matter of negotiation to come to grips with the problem. So both having both technical and social complexity defines what a wicked problem is. An important reflection from my point of view with respect to wicked problems is that it is very difficult to point something objectively to the in the outside world where we might all agree on that it is a wicked problem. I look at it as, let's say, from a constructivist perspective, meaning that also agreeing or identifying a problematic situation as wicked is a matter of a social agreement. So we might look at, you know, things that catch newspaper headlines today. For example, the refugee crisis. It's a very obvious challenge. We can all appreciate the complexity of that challenge, and I think it has or it makes a good case for being a wicked problem. But still, it is a matter of agreement. Because from my point of view, a wicked problem and acknowledging that something has a wicked character is, in the first place, is an invitation to look at it in a different way and to acknowledge that there is not an obvious solution. I would maybe like to go back to the 16th century, 17th century rather, when we had the 30 Years' War in Europe, which was a very destructive conflict. And at that point in time, I think all the key intellectuals in Europe were looking for ways to find some piece of solid ground under our feet. And for example, Stephen Toulmin, in his famous book Cosmopolis, has told that story about how, for example, Leibniz, you know, was looking for a universal language with the aim to have those, you know, parties that were engaged in, you know, vicious conflict, you know, to enable them to talk to one another. I mean, the fractures were of a religious nature, and so there was a search for solid ground, intellectually speaking, socially speaking. And so René Descartes, the famous French philosopher, he developed a kind of an intellectual methodology or an intellectual stance where he went back to what he called, you know, undoubtable ideas. And from that solid platform, he erected a whole way of thinking, which we would now characterize as, you know, reductionistic. And I mean, we've been building on that legacy, and I mean, no doubt it has brought us a lot of benefits, and it has been tremendously successful, you know, in bringing us to where we are at this point. But on the other hand, I think we also more and more start to see, let's say, the limitations of it. That's what I think is A small line in that story is the development and the birth of a notion such as wicked problems, because that's, from my point of view, it heralds a kind of a new intellectual paradigm shift, I would say. So that's, from my point of view, the importance of this notion of wicked problems. Talking about or reflecting on the limitations that are, let's say, science-based, reductionistic way of dealing with complexity is running into. You know, we can look at a number of different phenomena where we are confronted with today. I'm just mentioning a few of those. For example, one of the statements that is made today is that we are entering what is called the Anthropocene. So the Anthropocene is an analogy with, for example, the Holocene is a geological period, and what it expresses is the fact that human beings today are the most decisive force in shaping the long-term fate of our planet. So it's Anthropos, meaning human beings, as the most important factor that impacts on the fate of our planet. That is a new phenomenon. I mean, the term has been coined in the year 2000, and this realization that we are entering this new era is gaining ground. Another phenomenon that we are seeing are these famous hockey stick curves. For example, one of the famous curves is the rise of global surface temperature, which has been used in the United Framework Convention on Climate Change, say, argument to do something and to tackle climate change. And we see those kinds of hockey stick curve where you have an initial period of very slow growth of a particular phenomenon that then suddenly starts to rise very quickly. So it's kind of an exponential growth. Those curves we see increasingly often. And it's not only about global surface temperature. It can be, global population. It can be referring to, for example, the adoption of mobile phones. And I think if we develop a similar curve, for example, for the number of refugees that are flowing into Europe, it would be very, very similar kind of curve. What it all refers to is dynamics that are reinforcing. So we are actually seeing in the background a reinforcing feedback loop, meaning we are looking at phenomena or processes that actually are moving systematically further away from an equilibrium. And that means that something is out of control, basically. So that's another element in that, say, complexity where we are confronted with today. And maybe a final element, and it's by no means is an exhaustive inventory, but of course, I mean, the advent of the internet and the global connectivity that we are currently witnessing, I mean, that is, let's say, in historical terms, is, yesterday. And it remains to be seen. It has already had a huge impact, but it remains to be seen what it's going to mean for future generations. So these are all, I would say, indications that we are witnessing indeed important transformations at a global scale. On the other hand, I don't think that our problem-solving capacity is keeping step with those developments. So there we have this gap, the gap between our ability to absorb complexity and the growth of that complexity itself. And that's where systems thinking potentially comes in. I mean, increasingly we hear today that, systems thinking is going to help us, to deal with those global interconnected problems. And so the question is, whether systems thinking is able, to fulfill that promise, and whether it is willing to fulfill that or take that challenge. And to be honest, I'm not sure of that. From my point of view, there is a very clear overlap and synergy between what is today called design thinking and systems thinking, in the way I describe it, as this clever way of tinkering, so to speak, tinkering with complex problems. Design thinking, by definition, is an iterative approach. It relies on designers' expertise in the area of observation. So it's about careful observation. It's about synthesizing and reframing almost. Yeah, synthesizing and reframing these observations into something that leads to a kind of clear design brief or design challenge, an expression of a design challenge. And then you move on, you know. Typically what designers do is actually, you know, they start to work in a very problem-oriented way by making prototypes and so on and so on. This kind of very voluntaristic, almost idealistic way of, you know, coming to grips with that complexity, you know, you start to tackle it at a certain, from a certain vantage point, and by constantly iterating, you know, you build up a much more multidimensional understanding of that complexity. That, I think, is something that I see and recognize, you know, very, very emphatically in that kind of tinkering understanding almost, or conception of systems thinking. So from my point of view, there is an obvious synergy. The only thing is that we're dealing with two epistemic communities, designers and systems thinkers. They have similar ambitions. They, to an extent, use similar tools, but there's also differences in the tools. And they use similar words, but different language. For example, we all talk about, for example, scenarios. Well, a designer will, as a rule, understand this in a very different way than a systems thinker does. But if we look a little bit closer at what systems thinking is, it appears that it is not so easy to characterize it. I mean, if you Google, then you will find, let's say, the first 10 pages of links will refer you to sources on a very specific, I would say, sub-discipline within the field, which is system dynamics, and which has been popularized notably by people such as Peter Senge. But that's only part of the story. It's a valuable, let's say, contribution that's been made, but it's by no means, you know, the old story of systems thinking. There's a chart or a diagram that I really love, and that's a genealogical tree that's been developed by the International Institute for General System Studies, and that shows, so to speak, the origin of systems thinking, historically speaking. And, well, it starts about 3,000 years before Christ, and it leads up to the most avant-garde application, for example, of computer linguistics. So we have Babylonian astronomers, we have computer linguistics and complexity theory, and from my point of view, if you look at the chart, you can identify any significant intellectual contribution of the last, well, millennia. And so that's an indication of the fact that it's very difficult to really draw a boundary around this whole discipline of systems thinking. And so that's I think, an indication of the fact that the field, which suggests, I would say, a certain intellectual rigor and a certain homogeneity, is in fact far from homogeneous and intellectually consistent. So we have different schools in systems thinking, and even the whole field is crisscrossed by different and very different intellectual paradigms. From my point of view, what is really significant is the distinction to be made between what is called hard systems thinking and soft systems thinking, whereby the hard systems thinking is more, I would say, an extension of the engineering paradigm. The idea there is that we look at complexity in the outside world, we develop models of that complexity, and with these models then we are going to decide where we're going to intervene. So the basic idea is that we are able to develop, say, simplified but still relevant and intellectually rigorous models of that complexity. In the soft systems approach, the vantage point is very different. There we are, say, considering, studying complexity, but the systemicity is not in the models that we build, but in the way we use those models to guide our process of inquiry. So it is the process that is actually systemic. And the basic ambition of the soft systems approach is not to develop, say, the ultimate model of that complexity, but is to develop a very pragmatic learning approach to come to grips with that complexity on an ongoing basis. So as Riddle said, the idea is not to solve it, the issues or the problems, but to resolve them again and again. And that's, from my point of view, is the soft systems approach. That's what its richness consists of. And inevitably, when you put it like that, the social element, the social dimension of wicked problems, you know, comes center stage. Because it's not only an issue of describing what we see out there, but it's also an issue of being aware that what we see there and the way we articulate it is a matter of framing, is a matter of, you know, worldview. And what soft systems does is actually to organize the confrontation between different worldviews in such a way that it can lead to constructive intervention with an eye to improvement. Not optimization, improvement of that problematic situation.